I had a talk prepared for you this evening, and in light of what's happened in Paris over the last couple of days, it just didn't seem like what needed to be said, and the reminder that that is of so many atrocities that are happening around the world. I was going to speak more on some of the intellectual debates that surround this question of suffering and why God would or wouldn't allow it. And I think those are really important debates. I didn't grow up as a Christian. I wasn't a Christian when I got to university. To be honest, I thought Christianity was for people who were stupid, or I thought it was for people who didn't think hard enough. And actually a big part of me coming to faith was me being convinced that I was very wrong about that, that actually Christianity could make sense up here as much as it does down here. I then spent about 5 years doing a PhD on the question of whether Christianity can hold up intellectually, and specifically this question of suffering. So I think those intellectual debates are really important. But today, following the horrors that we've seen in France and the reminder that that is of so many horrendous evils around the world, we're in crisis. So much of the world is in crisis. And when you're in a state of crisis, the most pressing questions I don't think are abstract, philosophical, intellectual questions, but more urgent questions. Questions like, what do we need? What do we need right now? What do we need as a human race when we're confronted with this type of horrendous evil? What do we need to even begin to approach this with integrity and with hope? Those are the sorts of questions that I've been asking myself over the last 2 days, and ones that I thought would be more appropriate to discuss tonight, still obviously on our theme. And I thought I would just start with a prayer, if you don't mind. I'm standing my ground, God, shouting for help. At my prayers every morning, on my knees each daybreak, why, God, do you turn a deaf ear? Why do you make yourself absent? For as long as I remember, I've been hurting. I've taken the worst you can hand out, and I've had it. I'm bleeding, black and blue. The only friend I have left is darkness. I feel worn. God, you have wasted me totally. You just stand there and let them do it. Let wicked people do what they want with me. Now my face is blotched red from weeping. Look at the dark shadows under my eyes. Even though I've never hurt a soul, and my prayers are sincere. I think it's amazing that those prayers are in the Bible. Word for word, those are prayers from the Bible, and they're prayers of some of the heroes of the faith from the Bible. And I think that's so important right now in the context of what's happening in our world. You can always bring suffering to God, no matter what we've been through, even if all you can muster up is anger and frustration towards God, He still wants to hear it. The Bible itself depicts Jesus as weeping at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. And the Greek word that's used there is the same word that's used of a horse when a horse gets so frustrated and angry that it rears back and just snorts uncontrollably. The Christian God knows what it is to be fiercely angry and to weep fiercely at the evil and the suffering of this world. And so your prayers to him don't have to be nice and polite all the time. You can be real with God at a time like this. And my personal experience, at least, is that it's often in those times where I just give God my honest, raw, messy, emotional prayers that I begin to see a way through whatever it is that I'm dealing with or others are dealing with. In the face of what has happened in France, I think we need a God who allows us to be angry and who is angry himself. That's the first thing that I think we need. Second, I think we need to be able to say that what happened in Paris is wrong. We need to be able to say that the world is broken and this is not the way that it's supposed to be. Here is Richard Dawkins' depiction of an atheistic universe. He says, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. This is not good enough. Okay, that is not good enough for those who have suffered and died in France. This is not good enough for their families. And I think this is the key question. If God is not going to be the foundation by which we support the claim that some things are absolutely good and some things are absolutely evil, then what is? Then what's going to fill that gap? And it's very hard to say. There was a famous BBC debate on this point between the Christian philosopher Frederick Copleston and the atheist Bertrand Russell. And when Russell was asked how he differentiated between good, real good, and bad or evil, this is what he had to say. He said, "The same way I distinguish between blue and yellow." And then Copleston replied, "You distinguish between blue and yellow by seeing them. So you distinguish good and bad by what faculty?" And Russell said, "By my feelings." Feelings was the best that Russell could come up with in response to that. And that is really problematic. Because some people feel like loving their neighbors, and some people feel like killing their neighbors. What makes one of those the good feeling, and the other the evil feeling? Nothing merely human will do the job. Why should I prioritize my feelings over your feelings? Or my society's feelings over your society's feelings? Without a transcendent good, an ultimate standard to turn to, all you are left with is fickle human preferences. You like vanilla ice cream, I like chocolate ice cream. I don't like killing, you do like killing. No right or wrong, absolutely, but only mere preference. And the only way that I know how to say that there is an ultimate standard according to which some things are really evil is by believing that at the center of the universe is someone who is goodness itself. A stable, objective, unchanging, reliable standard according to which we can say some things really are good and what happened in France and in other places around the world really is evil. Here's a third thing that I think we absolutely need at this time. We need to believe that every single human life is sacred and valuable and worth protecting. That may seem like a really obvious statement to make, but I think it's such an obvious statement because we live in a culture which has been so heavily influenced by the idea of Christian love. Love not only for one's tribe or one's religion or for the people who treat you well or for the people who are like you or for the people who are most useful to you or the people that you can get something from. Love for every single person. That was a radically distinctive idea in the Old Testament, in the ancient Jewish culture, and then in Christian tradition. Christians call it grace. Love that is not dependent on merit. It is love that you don't need to earn or work for or win or deserve. It is love for you that is exactly the same on your best day and on your very worst day. That is such good news. It's the love of a good parent for a newborn child. The question, why do you love your child? That doesn't even make sense to the parent looking over a newborn child. What do you mean, why do I love her? It's my child. I made her. She's in my image. She has my nose. Nowhere, I think, is this love more prominently displayed than when Jesus was hung on a cross to die. I've always been impacted by this quote by Sigmund Freud. He said, "When you are pushed to your visceral limit, the real you comes out. When you're in the worst pain, at the point of greatest frustration, when you're insulted and stepped on again, that's when you find out something about what's really inside. I know what comes out of me in those times is often not very attractive. What came out of Jesus was absolutely extravagant divine love. The Roman judge concluded that there was no charge against him, but the Jewish leaders were insistent that he be killed because he had claimed to be God. And so they stripped him and they beat him. They strung him up on a cross to be shamed publicly and to slowly die one of the most painful deaths that you could die. Jesus looked down from that cross at the people who were killing him and said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." If Jesus forgave even then, we can be assured that there is no sin that he will not forgive when we will just ask. Then Jesus turned to his mother and his best friend from the cross, and he said, "Mother, here is your son." And to the disciple, he said, "Here is your mother." And from that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Even as he hung dying, Jesus' first concern was not for his own life, but for his mother's life, and with ensuring that she would be cared for after he was gone. And then one of the criminals who was being executed alongside Jesus began to heap insults at Jesus. He said, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal on Jesus' other side rebuked him. He said, "Don't you fear God? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." The final thing that Jesus did on the cross, as he was struggling to take his final breaths, was to love the man next to him, a criminal, and to promise him salvation in response to his repentant heart and his trust in him. When the centurion, the soldier who stood there in front of Jesus, saw how he died, he exclaimed, "Surely this man was the Son of God." When he saw how Jesus died, he knew that he was God. Because as Freud said, when you're pushed to your limit, the real you comes out. And when Jesus was pushed to his absolute limit, what came out of him was absolute, extravagant, divine love. What came out of him was the unconditional love of God for every single person. And that is why it is never okay to treat people as anything other than sacred and absolutely worthy of dignity and respect. You are sacred because of the one thing about you that can never change. Have you ever wondered about that question? Is there anything about me that could never change? My looks are going to change. My wealth is going to change. My relationships are going to change. Every atom in my body changes every 7 years or so. Is there anything about me that never changes? And the one thing about you and every other single person that never changes is that you are unconditionally loved by God. And there is nothing that you could do and nothing that anyone else can do to ever change that. Fourth, when we're faced with unspeakable evil, we need a God who is committed to justice. We need a God who in the end is not just going to say, "It's no big deal what happened this weekend." We need a God who is not going to just turn a blind eye to horrendous evils. We need a God who's committed to justice. But at least for myself, when I have that thought, it quite quickly makes me feel uncomfortable. Because I can only speak personally. But when I see what happened in France, I find myself absolutely disgusted. And initially, I tell myself that the reason I'm absolutely disgusted is because it's so foreign to me. I say, "Who could ever do such a thing?" And in my heart, I'm saying, "I would never do such a thing." But in my most honest moments, I do admit to myself that the disgust that I have when I hear news of something like this, it's not only because it's so foreign to me, but it's also because I recognize a semblance of evil in my own heart. I ask questions like, if I had been raised as they were raised, if I had been taught what they have been taught. What might I have done? And personally, I find those very tough questions. There was a boy named Ewan who I used to fight with as a teenager. He wasn't a very nice kid. I wasn't a very nice kid either. And I can remember taking every opportunity I could to put him down. A few years ago, I found out that Ewan had killed himself. And there's a verse in the Bible that says, "For the wages of sin is death." And I had read that line dozens of times before I heard this news. And I don't think I ever really understood it. Sometimes when I try to explain the Christian idea of sin to people, they want to tell me that I'm exaggerating. You know, really, I'm a pretty good person. It's not like I've killed anyone. And actually, I find that a much harder question to answer than you might think. And what if God shone a light not just on the rippling effects of my sin and the suffering that played a part in causing in Ewan's life, but on the rippling effects of all of my unkind words and actions over the years? I can remember some things that I used to do, like the way that I treated Ewan, that now I can recognize as being truly terrible. At the time, I thought they were no big deal. Now I can recognize them as truly terrible. Now that God has led me away from some of those things, I can look back and see them for what they truly were. And I'm right about those things now. I was wrong then. Now I can look back and see them for what they truly are. Well, imagine how far along this path God is. Imagine what His perspective must be like. I've taken minimal steps at best. What would our sin look like from God's perspective? Would lust look like adultery? Would what we consider minor selfishness, would it look like murder? What happened in France is a specific tragedy, and it requires a specific response. But I think it's also a lens into the reality of every human heart, and in our most honest moments, what we can recognize as the darkness that is also there. I know my temptation when I do things wrong is to find someone that I can compare myself to, somebody down the street or somebody on the 6 o'clock news who's done something worse than me, and then I feel better about myself. And I say, sin is that guy's problem. Sin is not my problem. But what if the real standard of goodness is not some guy down the street or on the news, but the very heart of God? And the incredible news of the Christian faith is that God loved every one of us and every person too much to let us bear the judgment for the sin, for the darkness in our hearts, the things we've done wrong, and the consequences that that has had. Some of you, like me, have treated other people very badly. Some of you have been treated very badly by others. People in France have been treated terribly over the last couple of days. And that matters to God. The cross where Jesus died is where God says that it's not okay to just look the other way when people are abused and enslaved and tortured and murdered. It's not okay to say, no big deal. There do have to be serious consequences for sin. God is committed to justice for those who have been terribly wronged. But the cross is also where God says that He can't stand to see any of those that He has created be the ones to pay the punishment and the consequences for that sin. So what does He do? He takes the consequences on Himself. He takes the punishment on Himself. Justice demands judgment. Love demands mercy. And the cross where Jesus died is the only place that I know of where perfect love and perfect justice are in perfect intersection. In the greatest act of love I have ever heard of, God traded places with us. He took the death that we were headed for, and in its place He offers us a completely clean slate, new life. Listen to these words of hope from the Bible. though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. As far as the east is from the west, that is how far God has removed our transgressions from us. Christianity is an invitation to deal first and foremost with the evil in our own hearts, to give that to God, to nail that to the cross, to be rid of guilt, to be rid of regrets, and to step into a life where we can become the people that we know deep down we were created to be and the people that we need to be for the people that we love most. That's four things I think we need. Fifth, we need someone who is willing to suffer with those who suffer, alongside them. When I was about 6 years old, maybe seven, I was out on my neighbor's front lawn, just next door, and we were playing American football. There I am. I'm wondering why you were laughing. I was out on my next door neighbor's front lawn. We were playing American football, and I was playing with some older kids. I was getting knocked around pretty good. I started crying, and I went running home to my mom, who was on our front porch. There's mom, sporting the classic 80s onesie. Like that. I came running home to my mom, who's on the front porch, and I'm crying, and I'm saying, I'm not tough enough. I'm not tough enough. So guess what my mom does? She gets in this position, quite an athletic stance, in front of me. She did what any loving mother of a six-year-old son would do. She positioned herself like this. She hung her nose out in the air. She looked at me lovingly. And then she said, punch me in the nose. You are tough enough. Punch me in the nose. I know what you're thinking. Crazy Americans. And at first, I did. I just looked at her like she was crazy. And indeed, she was. But she persisted. She kept saying, punch me in the nose. Punch me in the nose. And I don't know what sort of psychological state I must have been in, but finally I did. I reared back and I gave my mom a straight right hand to the nose. And to my astonishment, blood began to come out of my mom's nose and began to drip down her face. But then came just one of the most just beautiful images from all of my childhood. Through this blood that was on my mom's face came the most dazzling, just radiant, joyful smile. And my mom said, now get back out there. And mom sent me back out into that game, and she went inside to get cleaned up. You might not know what to make of that story. Okay? Fair enough. What a bizarre thing for my mom to do. What an unthinkable, messy, bloody thing for her to do. But I also think, in at least one sense, what an amazing display of love. My mom chose to bring me into this world knowing that there would be suffering. But that didn't make her evil. That doesn't mean that she doesn't love me. Why? Because when suffering came, and when my eyes filled with tears, she bent down, she stepped into my suffering with me, even though that meant suffering at the hands of her own child. And for me, that's one picture of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. Where God did something unthinkable and messy and bloody, where God bent down and stepped into our suffering by becoming human himself, even though it meant suffering at the hands of those that he created, even though it meant ultimately giving his life for us. Why? Because I think that's what a loving parent does. A loving parent does whatever it takes to make sure that their child does not suffer alone. In Jesus, we do not have a God who remained comfortably seated on some far-off heavenly throne as we suffered. We have a God, in fact, the only God, who loves us enough to come and suffer with us. And that is one of the biggest reasons why I know that I can trust him through even the worst that this life has to offer. And finally, the last point I want to make I think in times like this, we need hope. We need hope for the future. I don't think atheism has an answer to suffering. I saw a commercial recently which showed a baby being born. The mother was in the hospital. The baby was born. And then the commercial fast-forwarded at rapid pace for the next 30 seconds through the entire life of the child. And before you knew it, the child was old and gray and hunched over and then went crashing into a grave, dead. And then the screen went blank and the words came across the screen, "Life is short. Play more Xbox." And it was funny, but it was also devastating. Really? Is that the best that we've got? Life is short. We're all headed for suffering and injustice and death. So let's just play more Xbox. Let's just distract ourselves so that we don't think about it and we don't consider it because there's nothing we can do about it anyway. I found it at the same time funny and really depressing as well. I don't think atheism has a response to suffering. But what the Bible promises is so, so different. This is how the Bible describes heaven. God's dwelling place is now among the people, and He will dwell with them. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Did you ever notice that? Not just that the tears will be wiped from our eyes, but He Himself will wipe every tear from our eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. In atheism, your life will end in suffering. In Christianity, suffering will end, and your life will never end. A few months ago, one of my students, named Arielle, she found out that she has a rare medical condition that makes her brain prone to bleeding, and that she would probably die within a few years. And shortly after that, she shared with me that there was a moment in which she found herself looking in the mirror, and she was looking at the limited mobility that she had on her right side from this condition. And the questions that she found herself asking were, is this the strongest that I will ever be? Is this the healthiest that I will ever be? Is this the prettiest that I will ever be? And then she shared with me the overwhelming peace that came over her as she remembered the answers to those questions. No, absolutely not. There's a day that will come where her body will be able to do far more than it's ever been able to do before. I know that you love snowboarding, so I asked her the question, do you think there will be snowboarding in heaven? And I wish you could have seen how unhesitatingly and how confidently she responded. And she said, absolutely. And soccer, too. And I wish you could have seen the smile on her face as she said it. Why could Arielle respond like that? Why could she respond with such conviction? Because God Himself wiped away her tears. Because despite the agony of her suffering, she knew that God loved her, that He was with her, that He was willing to suffer alongside her, and that one day He is personally going to set things right. Some people think the problem of suffering should push us away from God. For me, when I consider what it is that we need when suffering hits hardest, I think it's precisely because I experience suffering so strongly that I'm led to trust a God who is loving enough and powerful enough to do something about it. I hope that's an encouragement. Why don't we just pray as I close? Lord, I thank You that I can turn to You when there's suffering in my own life. Lord, and when my heart cries out for the suffering that I see in others. I thank You that there is no depth of agony or despair that we can experience in this life that You don't understand. Jesus, I thank you that the day before you died, you said to your friends, my heart is sorrowful even to death. That you understood sorrow even to the point of death. Lord, I thank you that there's no extent that you wouldn't go to, even though it cost you your own life, in order to make sure that one day suffering could be defeated in our lives and that we could live in relationship with you in a place where there will be no mourning or death or crying or pain for all eternity. Lord, we look forward to that, and we ask that you would comfort and be with those who are suffering right now as we wait for that. We trust you in Jesus' name. Amen.